And if I put a perfect short circuit on that turn, then the magnetic field would not be allowed to change inside of that. And that's the explanation by which superconducting cryogenically cooled materials can create levitation above a strong magnet. And we've seen some of those demonstrations by YouTube. Pretty good ones, by the way. So the moving magnetic field induces a voltage. There was no voltage to begin with in that bar magnet. I can therefore possibly make a more modern model of a TEM wave, which is bubbles of magnetic field, not necessarily any E field there. When the bubbles of magnetic field encounter a conductor, like my dipole antenna or like my solenoid coil, then a voltage is introduced, and I could have simplistically in the past say, yeah, the voltage was there on that moving wave. That's what made the pointing vector E and H at right angles spatially. But do we really know an E field was there? Because if we try to use the E field that we think is there, you're running into three problems. I won't go there yet. All you needed was the magnetic field. The magnetic field encountering the conductor of your antenna induces the E field that eventually results in a signal that goes down the transmission line. You see where I'm going with this one?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, I think what I'm seeing here, Dick, is this. The magnetic field in free space encounters a wire. A current is induced in the wire, and of course a current across a wire induces a voltage. So we have the current-voltage relationship in the wire very well understood. Now let's work it backwards. We have a transmission antenna. A current is in that wire. A magnetic field is created around the wire at that particular point. Now the issue is we have two magnetic field paths, one around a transmission antenna, one around a receiving antenna. We know that currents are flowing in either antenna. Now the thing is, how do we couple the two together? In other words, how do we bring them together? Okay, the one idea that's being proposed here is that we have magnetic bubbles, that one magnetic bubble propels the next magnetic bubble. Here's where I've got an issue with that. And the problem that I see is this. If I have charge in free space, I can say that in a vacuum, I can have a mass on one side, a mass on the other side, and have a differential charge, which is a voltage across that area. But I don't need any electrons in between. I can have complete vacuum in between and still have a difference in charge across free space. Now, if the charge changes on one end as opposed to the other end, I can say that the voltage, okay, is changing at the speed of light because I have a ratio of between a change in charge and the speed of light. If I were to look at all the equations, let's drop for a second. If I look at all magnetic equations, I have no relationship to basically any kind of magnetic field or field intensity and the speed of light. So the issue being, how do I propel or create motion with an H field? In other words, okay, yes, I have a change in current, and the change in current is a direct ratio to the magnitude of that H field. So yes, that's a relationship, but there's nothing that gives me a vector that says, okay, that varying H field can move another varying H field around it. I don't have anything to propel against. Like the example of the counterpoise, you have something to push off of. Here in free space, if I just have a magnetic bubble, it needs something to push off of. It needs something to connect and couple to. The E field at right angles, see, I don't need electrons in free space to create that E field. All that I need is basically a charge in free space or vacuum. And then from that, I can couple to the next H field. So as long as that proportion is always maintained, my electromagnetic field is happy. But without an E field, I don't see how you can propel the next H bubble. KC2QIQ.
Now, there's two areas we're glossing over here, Glenn. Let me backtrack a little bit. Ordinary power transformer, primary winding, secondary winding. The primary winding has current flowing through it. It's creating a magnetic field. That cyclically changing magnetic field encounters the secondary winding. The secondary winding, therefore develops a voltage. If I put the secondary winding open circuited, connected to nothing, or I connect it to a perfect voltmeter, infinite impedance voltmeter, I will measure real voltage across the secondary winding, very predictable by knowing the number of turns and the rate of the change of the magnetic field in those turns. So voltage is created by the rate of change of magnetic field. And that is not yet a current. If I put a load on the secondary winding of the transformer, yes, current flows. But the first thing that the voltage does, the first thing that the change of magnetic field, is it creates a potential difference, volts, on that wire. And only when I put a load resistor there do I make current flow. And then Lenz's law takes over, starts creating a bucking magnetic field. So now, when it comes to what we think is an E field in space, created by a TEM wave, and we think the E field is going to hop onto our antenna, I've got two problems. Number one, let me drop. In the example of the two capacitors, when we have a charged and an uncharged capacitor, it really is telling us three or four different things here. Number one, when you connected them together, a very large current flowed, and I believe a very strong magnetic field was created with essentially no E field. And that magnetic field radiated very nicely into space, number one. Number two, in order for me to create a transfer of the E field from the first capacitor to the second capacitor, I needed a particular ratio of those capacitors. In this particular example, the amount of charge I lost from the first capacitor and the amount of charge that I gained in the second capacitor happened to be 1-to-1, because they were equal-valued capacitors. If the first capacitor, the charged one, was picofarads, and the second capacitor was farads, very little charge would be transferred, because I started off with very little total energy to begin with. So you need, in order to get a quasi-equal transfer of E field, I need quasi-equal capacitors. Now let me show you the problem on that. Let me drop. You and I know that any real dipole we have ever built has an equivalent circuit, an LRC circuit. There's a real R, usually 73 ohms, a real L and a real C, and the ratio between those is the Q. You and I can measure the 3 dB bandwidth of the antenna. We can easily come up with a LRC circuit that is an equivalent circuit for that dipole. That equivalent circuit, LRC, has a real finite C. In order for that E field of space coming by my antenna to couple E field into that antenna, I have to have a substantial amount of capacitance in space with that E field in order to couple that charge into the capacitor of the equivalent circuit of my dipole. Here's the problem. How do I establish a substantial E field in space without any charged particles? How do I establish a substantial amount of capacitance of free space without any capacitor plates? There's no conductors out there. That capacitor in the experiment, when we put the two capacitors together, there were real conducting devices inside of that capacitor in the form of those plates that allow you to put real charge on them. I don't have those plates in free space. I don't have that capacitance. I don't have those charged particles. So the establishment of that E field in space is very difficult to explain. Very difficult to explain how it does any substantial amount of conversion of its free space E field into the E field under my dipole. The magnetic field does it beautifully. I don't think you need an E field in that TEM wave. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
The E field is displaced just like the H field is. It's a dimension. And what's actually happening is that if you look at the distance between your reception antenna and your transmission antenna, there is a coupled distance. And is there a capacitance between them? Yes. Is it the E field that is coupling to the antenna? No. It is the H field. The H field is intersecting the antenna. As the H field intersecting the antenna, yes, the current is flowing through the antenna and eventually can be generated back into voltage again. But as I said, in free space, in vacuum, around every H field, there's an E field, even though that there's no interreacting particles around it. But what's happening is at every 90 degrees, between geometrically, between each H field, there is an E field. And that E field is the vector, the pointing vector between two dipoles. So if you have two dipoles, it's the E field that is determining the polarity of the signal. In other words, if you didn't have an E field, you couldn't have polarization. It wouldn't be possible. In other words, if you just look at the vectors of H by itself and flux intensity B, and look at those two units, there's no polarity to them whatsoever. It's just like you're saying, a bubble in space. There would be no polarity. You couldn't have any kind of polarization to your signal. So just the mere displacement of polarization and displacement, the E field is the vector in the forward or the broadside to your dipole, and the H field is the path length at each cycle. Without the E field, Dick, I don't see how you can get a reproducible bubble to propel the next bubble.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay. By IEEE standard, we define the polarity, the polarization of an antenna by way of the E field. A horizontal dipole creates, in theory, horizontal E field, and we call it a horizontal polarized antenna. We know that the signal coming out of that horizontally polarized antenna, when measured at a far distance, are plane waves of E going left and right, parallel to the ground, for a horizontally polarized antenna, and the H field is vertical. The H field has polarity. By standardization, we have agreed to define the polarization of an antenna by way of the E field. There's a 50-50 chance we could have decided to change to decide the polarization of the radiated signal by talking about the polarization of the H field. The ferrite loop stick antenna inside that transistorized radio, 99% of what it's receiving is H field. It ignores the E field per se. And it has definite polarity. You aim that transistorized radio, you orient it in space just the right ways, and it does or doesn't pick up that H field and pick up that signal. By the way, when it comes to talking about the capacitance between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, let me drop. For any reasonable range outside of the near field of the antenna, that capacitance ain't worth talking about. To talk about that capacitance as a medium for transmitting signal, like Mr. Merle does in his articles, he's in the reactive near field of those two antennas. He's got a great big capacitor in space. Yes, he's using it. And in that example, yes, you can call that a longitudinal wave or a scalar wave if you want to. That's what you've got when you, if I take the individual plates of a capacitor that's got a sine wave of signal on it, and I draw a whole bunch of parallel plates in my way of analyzing what's going on between the two plates of a capacitor, there's a very predictable amount of cyclic E field in there, which I could call longitudinal waves if I want to. Inside of a capacitor, I've got longitudinal waves. But in real free space, of real transmission distance, the amount of capacitance between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna doesn't hack it. If you and I calculated the capacitance between the transmitting antenna on the Pioneer spacecraft right now, at 20 billion kilometers away from us, and the capacitance between the receiving antenna at Goldstone, forget it. The capacitance is not doing it. The E field, I'm not sure the E field has to be there. The magnetic field of that TEM wave coming across that tremendous amount of space, 33 hours of round-trip time at the speed of light. The magnetic field has polarity, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Can I add something?
Stand by. I want to hear what Glenn's got to say on this one. I don't want to change the subject yet. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, going back to my understanding again of why E field was used initially to generate polarity and everything else, is that in terms of charge, an E-field, E-field has a direct relationship to the speed of light. So in other words, if I want to look at an electromagnetic wave in free space, I always go back to C in vacuum, which is the speed of light. I can calculate directly from E-field to forward direction of the wave. In H, there is no, it's all ratios. That's what I'm trying to point out to you. There's no energy component. There was the H field itself, when you look at what it is, it's basically a relationship at 90 degrees to the E field. And as far as there being a minimum amount of capacitance necessary, I don't believe that a lot of capacitance is necessary. It's just that it's there. Because in order to establish, in other words, which field is dominant in free space, I agree, H, it becomes dominant. But without the E field directly coupled present to it on each cycle, there's nothing to couple the one cycle of H back to the next cycle of H, because it's just a ratio. Look at it numerically, what it really is. You'll find that, okay, you have magnetic field intensity, you have H, but there's no relationship to anything else, no more scientific units, you're done. Okay, you got Weber's, you've got Gauss, Tesla, path length, but path length is only one length in one wavelength. So in other words, it doesn't get you to the second wavelength or the second period. How do you get past it? How does it propel? How do you get cyclical rotation so that you can propel the next wave to the next distance? How does it displace over time and space? E-field allows you to do that with its relationship to the speed of light, so you can, that the wave moves. So the two have to be...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Glenn, the way you worded that, you made it sound like the energy of the TEM wave is an E field and an H field bouncing back and forth between each other. You made it sound like at one instant of time, you've got a lot of energy in the H field on this peak of that cycle, and then at some later portion of the cycle, the E field, the H field converts to an E field and they bounce back and forth. In the case of a LC circuit connected together sitting on a bench, yes, magnetic energy and capacitive energy, E field and H field, are coupling back and forth in an LC circuit. But there's a 90 degree phase shift between between the current and the voltage in that LC circuit. In the TEM wave in space, there is no temporal phase shift. They are co-phase. There is no 90 degrees of phase shift. And the peak of the E and the peak of the H occur at the same instant. The zero of the E and the zero of the H occur at the same instant, at the same point in space. I don't see evidence that E energy reflects into H and H energy reflects into E. They are time coincident, spatial coincident, but spatially rotated 90 degrees with reference to, orientated 90 degrees with reference to each other, but I don't see the energy flowing back and forth between the two. Your wording makes it sound like you believe that is taking place. Is that what you're saying, Glenn? KQLIW, you got it, Glenn.
Actually, no, that's not what I'm saying, but here's where I'm trying to move it along. The way you're describing it, okay, the field intensity of your H field as it's increasing, so in other words, when its Tesla value or Gauss value is at maximum, the E field is also at maximum at that point in space and time. But keep in mind, this is a path length. So in other words, when you're looking at a magnetic ratio, there's the B field and the H, which is one cycle. In other words, if this is taking place in one, or if you're looking at it in quarter cycles, 0 to 90 back down to 0 again, that's taking place over that path length of H, or lines of flux intensity. Now, the E field is also present, but geometrically at 90 degrees. The beauty of that is that when its amplitude is at maximum at that point, it has, at right angles to it in free space, the next bubble. It's the coupling factor. Think of it as like two links of chain on a desk. One link is in the vertical position, one is in the horizontal position. But unless you have the links opposing each other, they don't couple each other. Your chain won't hold together. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The C95 report, Glenn, is giving us another point of view on this. The C95 report, that's the one by the American National Standards Institute, which describes radio frequency biohazards, minimum permitted exposure, and all that kind of jazz. In the old days, we used to be allowed to expose a human being in an uncontrolled environment 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. I'm going back to the old days because I remember the numbers then. 10 milliwatts per square centimeter was allowed continuous exposure, uncontrolled environment. We've now lowered it to something below 1, but let's not go there yet. The reason I like the 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is because it is almost exactly 192 volts per meter of E field, 192 volts per meter, and very close to half an ampere per meter of H field. Because a wave in far field from an antenna becomes a complete TEM wave, the portion of that report where it wants you to report power flux density, it wants you to use milliwatts per square centimeter, and in those days, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter was allowed. When you go down to the lower frequencies, where the antennas become very large, and your distances become very small in wavelengths, and now you're inside the near field, and in some cases the reactive near field of the emitting device, which might be creating a radio frequency biohazard. Let me drop. In that area, when you've got curved fields, and you don't have a clearly defined, completely straightened out, planar RF field, they want you to use two separate sets of numbers and don't exceed either one of them. Down at the lower frequencies, where you're very close to the antenna, they don't want you to go above 192 volts per meter. They don't want you to go above a half an amp per meter. Half an amp per meter of H field or 192 volts per meter of E field. So, in theory, once I've got a really far field free space wave, I can thoroughly define its power flux density, watts per square meter, milliwatts per square centimeter, or I can completely define its magnitude by telling you its volts per meter, or I can completely tell you its magnitude by telling you its amps per meter. They are all interchangeable. They fly together. So if I had nothing but H field in the real wave, and it was half a volt per meter of each one of those bubbles, I know what the strength of that thing is coming to me. And I know that when it hits a conductor, that half an amp per meter hitting a conductor will induce into the conductor 192 volts per meter of E field. So one possible radical philosophy is I only needed the H. It creates the E when it hits a conductor. And the H all by itself has magnitude, direction of propagation, polarization. It's got all the properties I want. You made it sound like if I had nothing but H field, I can't make it fly. I don't have direction. I don't have magnitude. I don't have polarization. I think I've got all three. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I agree that when you have your conductor and you put your conductor in place of your H field, the local H field at the point of intersection, at that point in time there, everything works exactly as you said. But where I disagree is that what's happening is that once you start getting X number of cycles away from the antennas and you have your traveling wave, in order to complete each individual link, you need E to give you the vector, your vector of energy. And as I said before, the reason why is because E is the energy component. In other words, if you need the conductor with your H field to determine what the energy is. You don't need the conductor to determine the energy of just E, because E has all of the energy components within it. My point being, if you're translating a H field in space, I understand how in a single cycle analysis, in other words, you're saying, okay, I have a magnetic field, I intersect it with my wire. Now I know my energy component's there because your wire is completing the second half of the E field so that you can do your calculation. But in free space, the energy is assumed at dropping off at, inverse square law through free space. It is displaced. And that, if that energy exists in all points of space between the antenna and the reception antenna, or at any point of sampling. Therefore, in order to have an energy component, it must be available at all points in space. Now, if I have an H field, which is just a ratio, how does it propel? How does it couple to the next cycle in space? How is it polarized? If you, you understand what I'm saying, in other words, there isn't enough information in H with just ratios to determine power levels. In other words, you have to go back to create ampere.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, after you timed out, I had no trouble hearing you on the input, and you were talking about without the E, there's no energy. Without the H, you're saying the H alone can't give you energy. If I've got a magnetic field in an inductor, and I know how many Henry the inductor is, I know how much current is flowing through it, 1/2 Li squared, I know how much magnetic energy is stored in that inductor in joules. So pure magnetic field has energy in an inductor. It is my guess that pure magnetic field, cyclic magnetic field, at the RF carrier rate of a known number of amps per meter, has a continuous flow of energy, which I can define in milliwatts per square centimeter, or watts per square meter of power flux density. It has polarity, horizontally polarized wave, by the standards of the IEEE, where I define polarization as the E field, has a vertical H field. So if I know that the H field is 0.5 amp per meter in magnitude, if I know that it is oscillating at 100 million times per second, and I know that that maximum polarity of the magnetic field is vertical, I know its polarity, I know its frequency, I know its magnitude, I know its wavelength, I know its rate of propagation. What am I missing? It has energy. The magnetic field itself appears to have all the properties I need. It doesn't have to have an associated E field in my simplistic example right now. And when that H field, that cyclic, continuous power H field, continuous set of bubbles, strikes my antenna at 0.5 amp per meter of vertically polarized H field, will in my horizontal...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When it hits my horizontal wire, it will induce exactly 192 volts per meter on that wire. The H hitting the wire does that. The E didn't have to be there for that piece of wire to pick up the 192 volts per meter. The H hitting it does it by Faraday's law. So what am I missing? I know it doesn't fit the particular model with the particular Maxwell's equation. I'm trying to get around that. The cyclic magnetic field that my transmitting antenna issued was a disturbance in the media, like dropping a pebble into the puddle. It created a wave that spread out. I didn't have to push it. I was talking about the individual bubbles pushing against each other. I'm not sure I needed that. Any cyclic disturbance will spread automatically. The medium does that. All I need is a medium that will allow me to propagate a cyclic magnetic field. It's got magnitude, it's got frequency, it's got polarization, it's got direction of propagation, it's got antenna pattern. It seems to have everything I need. The E doesn't have to be there. It gets created when it hits the conductor. That's a possible way of looking at it. I know it's radical. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Comment?
Can I have a comment as well? Dick, we're going to have to pick up the comments, but let me explain this first. Let me see if I've got it. When we talk about energy, we talk about volts, we can talk about amperes, okay? We can talk about volts, amperes, and time, VBDT, VIDT, and all those relationships, and we can get back from electrical energy. When we're talking about magnetic field intensities and dimensions, they are ratios and ratios only, okay? Now let's go back to magnetic field. You said magnetic field has energy. What is the unit that you're using? Ampere meter. So it's the ampere that you're calling your energy over a meter, which is a length. What's the length? The length is a dimension. Okay? So what's happening is there's a problem with using magnetic fields, okay, for energy relationship. You can assume that there is a equivalent energy for a magnetic field, but it's always in units of electrical energy or E field. In other words, okay, you've got your magnetic field. How do you know that the magnetic field is there? You put a piece of wire in its place, and you create a current in it, and you measure that current in voltage. So all relationships that we know of energy are in E, or respect to change in current in wire, which comes back to electrons and mass. So that's the problem. That's the issue. So when you're talking about magnetic fields in free space, the magnetic ratios only account for a dimension. They don't account for the energy. You keep on going back to amperes again. Well, amperes are, guess what? That's all part of the E component. It's not standalone. Amperes do not stand alone. Ampere meters are not standalone energy units. K2IW, KC2, QIQ.
The guy wouldn't be able to say anything. He's got 10 minutes.
You've got to see the latest issue of Microwave Theory and Techniques. Because of the tradition you and I have lived with, Glenn, all of the instrumentation in our laboratory is voltage sensing. We've got voltage probes on our oscilloscopes. We've got voltmeters. There's nothing stopping us today to make our probes out of Hall effect devices, and we measure magnetic fields. Don't have to measure E-field. When I'm sending a signal down a coax cable, you and I just define the magnitude of that either in watts that flows or the voltage we get between the center conductor and the outer conductor. That's the convention. The latest issue of Microwave Theory and Techniques shows a brand new kind of transmission line, which they call magnetic transmission line. It sends magnetic fields down the medium, down the transmission line. And there is essentially no voltage that they bother measuring. There may be one, but they do it all in magnetics. Because, and by the way, the units of magnetic field in free space are amps per meter, not amp meters, amps per meter and volts per meter. So I can define all the parameters I want. I could have, for a bunch of traditional reasons, we did everything with E. We could have done it with H. It feels uncomfortable. I think it to be made to work. I know that Wes wants to make a comment. I know there was another person that said comment. What's your comment, Wes? Into XJN, K2LAW?
You are analyzing only one side of the scenario, which is the traditional one. But I love what you're talking about, and I love the subject. Well, the thing is that we were developing a theory of the bubbles, the one half of the cycle is positive, one is negative. If you talk about the special tri-dimensional vector-like pattern, for me it looks like the vortex, and that is Professor Mayo. Another thing is, when I ask you is the about the scenario with the capacitor, let me jump. I ask you is that the pressure wave, the magnetic wave that is created, well, both of you agreed that this is a pressure wave. For that, it does have all of the properties of the scalar wave, therefore falls into the description of Professor Mayo and Eric Dodd. So, just a few words about that. Now, the discussion tends to stay about the magnetic field and the active role of the magnetic field that is doing in between two antennas or two capacitors. I wonder what you can say about that, Dick. Next week, if you could please read more about Professor Mayo, and we could pick up the subject anyhow, I would appreciate that. It will help. Dick, pick up.
Have you read the report by Horst Eckert, which is entitled What Are Scalar Waves? January 2nd, 2012. And he is addressing all of the previous things that were written by Mayo. Have you seen the Horst Eckert report? Over to you, Wes, K2 WP2LAW?
No, I don't believe I did. I thought that the information that I have sent to you and to Glenn are preliminary and too soon to the ZECNET, and you would probably not have a time to go deeper into it. But that's what you're doing right now, is you are going to the certain direction. I'm not trying to implement anything more that you're doing right now, but it does, for me, have a properties of scalar wave. That's what you're talking about. You admitted about the pressure wave of existence at 2 at the same time. Do we have a vortex or we don't have a vortex, Professor Mayo? Because of the plus and the minus of the circle and the virtual tridimensional spatial representation of it.
Yeah, Mayo in some of his other reports talks about the scalar waves have all of these desirable characteristics when you put medicines near them and you put human beings near them, and it cures all of their diseases. He's got an awful lot of very, what's the word for it now? Spiritual is not the word.
Huckster.
What was that?
Huckster.
I know, he's a sincere guy, but he's into some very occult-like things. And so, and once you read this report by Horst Eckert, a very respected guy, who in a very nice language talks about the real non-existence of scalar waves and the real, yes, inside of a capacitor, in the near field of the two plates, you have something you can call scalar waves, and you can call them, I forget what the other word was, but you know what I mean, longitudinal waves. But that is not a significant free space propagation that has any real range to it. Real radio, we don't operate it over a couple of feet. We operate it over miles. And this circuit, the circuit these talk about, I am convinced, and these other reports are convinced, does not have the capability of transmitting for miles. So it's hard to get into that.
That's the thing about it.
That's now changing the subject. The other person who said that they had a comment, who was that?
It would be utilization of the scalar wave, the one wires, the EF structure. The same as Eric Zollard, the same as Nikola Tesla, and the same as Marconi.
Yeah. Go to Victor David Henry with comment. Victor David Henry, give me the full call and your name, sir, and then your comment. K2RIW.
Fine business. Yeah, the call is WA2VDH. Name is John. The only comment I wanted to make is that about doing everything with the H field, how can you involve the velocity of propagation, C, which is determined by the permittivity and the permeability? And unless you involve the E field, you're not going to involve the permittivity, so you really don't get a velocity of propagation out of it. Go ahead.
With the conventional way of describing it with the Maxwell's equations, with the currently used popular model, you're absolutely right, John. However, I suspect there is the possibility of a different model. Yes, there is an EH relationship of space. There's a dielectric constant. There's a permittivity. There's an E0, there's a mu0 of space. And all of those terms fit the current model. And most of those terms we can keep. But that E field in space of the TEM wave, since Faraday's law tells us that the E you generate is a function of the rate of change of H, or rate of change of B, rate of change of magnetic field. And because when you choose the peak of a TEM wave, where the slope goes to zero, the rate of change of magnetic field is zero, and at that exact same time, you have a peak of E at the exact same point in space. So if you say that the rate of change of magnetic field is creating the E field, and the rate of change of magnetic field at the peak of the wave where the slope is zero is the exact same place where the electric field is maximum, that doesn't explain it. There's a question there that we've never asked each other. How is that E field being created by the H field?
It's
2 QIQ. I have the answer to that.
Is it really there? Go ahead, Glenn.
The impedance or the reactance of free space is resistive. It's treated as resistive. And what's happening is all of our units for energy, L, DIDT, CDBDT, all the components of electrical energy that we basically convert to, that we measure with, are basically changes in voltage and current. So what's happening is, what is the magnetic relationship? The magnetic relationship are ratios to the electric field. So what's actually happening is those magnitudes are taking place at the same time, but they're 90 degrees apart from each other. They're a link. It's like a link in a chain. So what's happening is your relationship from each one is mathematically assumed all the way along the whole path. So in other words, you have an H field with an electric field 90 degrees opposed to it, and free space is treated as resistive. So it's interlinking all the way through, but the units are always DI DT over a meter. So like you're saying, it's ampere meter. So when you're calculating the units all the way through, they're all together. In other words, you can't just say, okay, I want the amperes, but I don't want the volts. It's like they all exist together, but they're taking place, like shifted in time and geometry in a resistive atmosphere, so that they always balance. K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
We talk about free space having an impedance of 377 ohms or 120 pi. 377 ohms are in what units? It could be called ohms per square. If I had a sheet of resistive material, and I tell you that this material has 377 ohms per square, and by the way, I can buy that material from Emerson Cumming. I can buy 377 ohm scrimshaw material. It's a thin cloth-like material with carbon granules deposited on it, and I can confirm the fact that it is 377 ohms per square. By that I mean I take 1 square meter of it, and I put a conductor along the upper 1 meter long edge. I put another conductor along the lower 1 meter edge. I put my ohmmeter between those two conductors, and I'll measure 377 ohms. If I do the same thing with 1 square centimeter, I'll measure 377 ohms. It's ohms per...
This is VE3JIW Gravenhurst. I don't know if I'm being heard, and I don't know if you realize this has become a 50% net. Now, VE3JIW Jim, Gravenhurst, Ontario.
Yes, you make people think, and I guess that's a good thing.
I've managed the whole session for the last month or bit. I'm up 100 miles north of Toronto, Mississauga Amateur Radio Club. A number of people in Toronto are tuning in on Sunday nights. We moved our Aries net to before 8 o'clock, so we avoided that conflict. And we added a longer timer that people can use to connect. So I think you had a number of people in Toronto, and definitely me in Gravenhurst, listening along. KC2WBE3, Juliet, India, Whiskey. It's Jim. Yes, John. Gravenhurst is a blink on a map, unless you get really near the place. I mean, 10,000 people does do a lot, but I listen to the amount of aggravation you sometimes get on 2 meters, and it's amazing that you have very little troubles in the Toronto GTA area with our club repeater that hosts the IRLP and 2 meter repeater on 2 meters. So I realize you're running into the problem, but no, got a number of people listening. Somebody bumped into it and passed the word. So I can see that at 12 o'clock it goes down, and as you mentioned, there was a website where you could actually get, I don't know if they're way, they're probably MP3s, but previous renditions. And we're going to have, you mentioned a voting system. We've got to do that because our repeater is a great site, but it's crowded by the development of, you know, a rural area to buildings that resemble Marilyn Monroe's legs, that you could Google it, that block our repeater to the northwest. I'm not northwest of the repeater. I'm a repeater manager for it. But anyway, nice net, and carry on. If you've been going 4 hours to change, you probably may want a break, and maybe the morning comes early for you. I'm on vacation at a cottage very similar to the Finger Lakes here. You'd be moving up here if you believed it. 63, but it warmed up through the day. I had metal cased airtight stove burning, and suddenly we're too hot here because it warmed up. But we've been seeing 37, 42 at night through the week. But right now I'm looking 62, 3 degrees. Well, thank you. 2 days more to be up here, and then back to Toronto and work and all that good thing. Keep it up. There's people out here listening. KC2WBG, VE3JIW. Anybody in Toronto listening, out of curiosity, anybody in Toronto listening, this is a VE3JIW.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.